Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. The smell of prison is what hits you first. The acidic reek of antiseptic is everywhere. Imagine taking everything under your kitchen sink, mixing it with sweat and despair, and that is what a prison smells like. No friends, no family, and you are surrounded by criminals, some much bigger and scarier than you. You live in a cage and only get a few hours of sunshine a day. That would be hell for most of us. But for Cindy White, prison was a sanctuary, a breathing space, and a refuge. I know what you're thinking. What happened to Cindy White that would make prison seem like a paradise? We talked about her tragic childhood, which was key to the arson she later committed that killed six people. Please listen to that episode before listening to this one. That was just the beginning of Cindy's story. What followed was a life of abuse and rape. And just when she believed that everything was going to be okay, her hopes were crushed by the reality of her new situation. At least in prison, she was safe from the kind of abuse she had suffered on the outside. The true tragedy in Cindy White's case was the death of four children. Yes, six people were killed, but only four innocent lives were lost. But Cindy White was also a victim. And before any judgments are made, it is important to listen to the rest of her story. I think you might feel, as I do, that her case is a tragic miscarriage of justice.
As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is Killer Psyche. I've spent five decades studying people's minds through my work
as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. And the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is part two of Cindy White. On one Friday afternoon, shortly before Reggie was set to walk through the kitchen door, Cindy was so fearful of what was in store, she fainted. An ambulance was called and took her to the local emergency room. When she regained consciousness, her left leg was paralyzed. The doctors were unable to figure out what was wrong, but fainting and paralysis are very serious symptoms and not usually seen in otherwise healthy teenagers. Concerned that she may have had a transient stroke or even a brain tumor, they kept her over the weekend for observation and testing. But by Monday, she was well again and returned home. However, because of her brief hospitalization, a whole new world opened up for Cindy. Upon arriving home, Reggie was already gone for the week. Miraculously, Cindy recovered and could walk again. Her mother called it the Lord's work, but Cindy secretly had her doubts. It slowly dawned on her that because of the hospital visit, she'd escaped her weekend tormentor. But Reggie was due home in a few days, and shortly before he arrived, Cindy once again fell to the floor unconscious. The paramedics revived her at home, but her left leg was, once again, numb and useless. The ER doctors ran more tests and found no cause for her paralysis. But this time, Cindy noticed their questions sounded more like accusations, as if they thought she was faking. She denied it, and out of an abundance of caution, they admitted her to the hospital once again for observation. However, when she returned home, she could not use her leg and had to stay in bed. She told me, quote, "Sometimes I thought I was faking, but sometimes I thought I was really paralyzed. To me, it was very real." Cindy's home life had become unendurable. In fact, very few children could have survived the abuse she underwent without suffering catastrophic damage to their brain and spirit. She found herself longing to be back in the hospital. Being disabled meant being ignored by her abuser, and that was a highly desirable alternative. It wasn't long before her mind figured out that partial paralysis came with benefits. When Reggie returned and saw his weekend victim bedridden, he wanted nothing to do with her. In Cindy's crippled state, she was sexually useless to him, and beating her surely would have brought unwanted attention, if not the police. This wasn't the reaction she expected, but it did put a smile on her face. Soon after Reggie went back to work on Monday, she recovered partial use of her leg, dragging it behind her. When he came home the next Friday, Cindy fainted for the third time in less than a month. The home-to-hospital two-day stay routine was repeated. Only this time, the doctors were anticipating her arrival and had formulated a new plan. They told Cindy's mother they thought her problem was not physical, but mental. They diagnosed her as having a hysterical paralysis, specifically that her paralysis was caused by extreme stress. The diagnosis is a psychiatric disorder known as a conversion reaction, It is one of several defense mechanisms, such as denial, rationalization, or projection, that our mind creates to help us get through the tough times of life. Conversion reaction is a rarely seen psychiatric malady. It meant that Cindy's paralysis, though not neurological in origin, was caused by an unbearable stress or trauma. Her subconscious mind converted it into a real physical symptom designed by nature to protect her. In her case, the trauma converted to paralysis of her left leg. This disorder is based on Sigmund Freud's theory that the psyche, meaning soul, mind, and spirit, converts extreme stress or fear into a physical impairment of the host. But it serves a greater purpose than the disability causes. Cindy's extreme and untenable fear of being abused by Reggie again converted or morphed into paralysis of a leg, thus shielding her body and psyche from further abuse. In a sense, the paralysis became her life raft. Being disabled made her useless to her abuser, thereby ensuring Cindy's survival. Although she didn't understand the psychodynamics of her malady, the fact she needed to be hospitalized was just fine with her. To be specific, she was elated. Her mother did not want to believe Cindy was mentally ill and was unwilling to deal with her eldest daughter's problems. She signed commitment papers sending Cindy to the county psychiatric hospital for long-term treatment. The nurses assisted Cindy with her basic activities of daily living, like transferring from the bed to her wheelchair, showering, and dressing. She'd wheel herself out to the large day room where all the patients gathered for meals and occasional therapeutic interventions, such as group therapy. In these sessions, she listened to other patients' problems and was encouraged to share her own troubles as well. Cindy was reassured by both staff and other patients that her participation would help her feel better and was strictly confidential. Skeptical about revealing the truth, Cindy remained silent. In her time at the hospital, Cindy saw a variety of psychiatrists, nurses, and social workers in private, one-on-one sessions, but never brought up her home life. She might have, but no one ever asked her about it. Not one time in the 10 months of her confinement. Today, therapists, social workers, doctors, nurses, and ER personnel are all trained in the art of interviewing a possibly abused patient. It takes patience and skill, and above all, an environment where the patient feels safe in disclosing the secret. When Cindy was confined to the hospital in rural Indiana, I was a young psychiatric nurse at one of the largest private psychiatric facilities in the country, Northwestern University Hospital's Institute of Psychiatry in Chicago, Illinois. It was only 190 miles from where Cindy had been committed. I saw most of the mental, behavioral, and emotional disorders that I'd studied in nursing school. Of the hundreds of mental disorders known to mankind, only a few of them ever result in hospitalization. Among them, out-of-control schizophrenia, bipolar mania, and suicidal depressions top the list. People suffering from these conditions need to be protected from themselves, and society needs to be protected from them during what I call their psychiatric storm. For many, if not most of them, when they recovered, you'd never know they'd been hospitalized for a mental condition. Yet, as cutting edge as we were at Northwestern, we did not ask our patients no matter how suicidal, homicidal, or gravely disabled they were, if they had been or currently were being abused. It was not an aspect of questioning anyone even remotely considered. Back in the 70s, the average stay in an inpatient unit was about 3 weeks. But now the average stay is 4 to 7 days. This is partly due to the faster-acting medications and the financial fact there is even less money to pay for psychiatric care now than years before. Cindy was not homicidal, suicidal at this point, or prone to fits of rage. She was technically, however, gravely disabled. She was unable to care for herself due to a mental condition, and she was not responding to treatment. Cindy never manifested any signs of psychosis, meaning she was not hearing voices or having delusional thinking. Her take on reality was intact, yet her doctors put her on the strongest antipsychotic medication available, Thorazine. All it did was cause her to sleep most of the time, blur her vision, and make her feel zombie-like. It did nothing to help her paralysis. But why would it? Conversion reaction is not a psychosis. It is a neurosis, a far less severe illness caused by high anxiety and/or emotional problems. Certainly her doctors knew that, but appeared to have been throwing every treatment modality they had at her. I'm surprised they didn't try ECT, which stands for electroconvulsive therapy, which would have been as inappropriate as the Thorazine was. But in those days, I saw it used a lot. Or perhaps I should say I saw it misused a lot. That Cindy was confined for 10 months without any improvement is a glaring example of how much things have changed in the past 35 years. Today, she'd probably be treated and released in less than 2 weeks and a Child Protective Services investigation initiated. She would not have been returned home, and her abuser would be arrested. Unfortunately for Cindy, psychiatric enlightenment on this issue had not yet been formed. During her stay, Cindy's mother died at the age of 46 from alcoholism. Cindy told me, quote, "At the funeral, Reggie glared at me. It reminded her of what she was in for when she returned home. And once again, Cindy considered suicide. Cindy had nothing good to go back to when she left the hospital." Cindy was not only coming up on almost an entire year of hospitalization, but also approaching the age of legal adulthood, 18 years old. That meant her psychiatrist would have to convince the Indiana State Funding Board that she was either hopelessly disabled, homicidal, or perpetually suicidal if she were to remain hospitalized. But there was another option that would eliminate the need to plead her case to the board. They could simply diagnose her as malingering. This is a clinical term for faking an illness. If that happened, they could bypass the review board by simply discharging her. Finally, they could wash their hands of this difficult teenager who was not responding to treatment. Their 10 months of therapy had been profoundly ineffective, but they didn't blame themselves for her failure to become healthy. They blamed Cindy. The staff was divided. Most of the nurses thought she was truly ill, but the psychiatrist leaned towards malingering. Nevertheless, it didn't seem to occur to either group of professionals why a teenager would fake a mental illness so severe. It removed her from her home environment for 10 months, and she never once complained about it. Of all the adolescent patients I have treated in psychiatry, none of them ever wanted to stay a minute longer than necessary. Most of them preferred a halfway house, a less than perfect home, or even the street to being hospitalized on a psych unit. But not Cindy. Faced with returning home, Cindy attempted suicide by slitting her wrist with a razor she'd stolen from Reggie. A staff member discovered her, and she was rushed to the hospital in time to save her life. After she returned back to the unit, a panel of doctors met with her and told her there was nothing more they could do for her, and she would be discharged in a week. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital on sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. After 10 months of sheltered care, the Indiana hospital was giving the boot to a very disturbed teenager who had no support system on which she could rely. What could possibly go wrong? The weekend before she was discharged, Cindy had her first visitor ever in the hospital. She actually had two visitors, Carol and Charlie Roberson. Her former neighbors told her that they wanted to help her. They asked if she would like to live with them again and help take care of the kids. They even offered to pay her a salary. She had such fond memories of the first time she lived with them, she immediately said yes. But there was one problem. She was still paralyzed. Then the oddest thing happened that night. She fell in her room and hit her head. When she woke up, she could walk again. Miraculous, right? Go figure. Did that mean Cindy had been faking her mental illness? Not necessarily. Cindy had already admitted to me that sometimes she believed she was paralyzed, and at other times, faking. The only thing she knew with absolute certainty is that going back home would be the death of her. Cindy hadn't had a lot of good things happen in her life and believed the Roberson's offer was a gift from God. Being paralyzed had served Cindy well for almost a year But now it was time to grab the next best thing, to keep herself safe. Cindy was discharged to the halfway house, but after a few days, the Robersons picked her up and happily brought Cindy to her new home. She was over the moon to be with the kids again. Everything was great. But something was new, a little extra attention from Charlie. She had lost a tremendous amount of weight, and she finally felt good about herself. All was going well in her new life until one day, Cindy told Charlie that her little sister was coming over to visit. This was the day, Cindy said, that their friendly employer-employee relationship changed. Charlie forbid it, saying her family was no good and she needed to break the bonds with them now. Angry and upset, Cindy decided to pack up and leave. As she was walking out, Charlie grabbed her, forced her into a bedroom, and locked the door. An hour later, she was told that she could come out if she would not leave. Cindy agreed because she had nowhere to go. However, she now saw Charlie in a different light, and she no longer trusted him. Things took an even darker turn when Carol took a job on the night shift. One evening, Charlie told her to put the kids to bed early so that they could have a movie night. Cindy felt that something was off, and this made her nervous. By this time, the schoolgirl crush on her savior had morphed into fear of her captor. Charlie made Cindy watch porn movies with him as he masturbated. When she seemed uncomfortable, he gave her pills that relaxed her. He then told her he loved her. She wondered aloud about Carol, but he told her not to worry. The pills made her lightheaded and drowsy, and she was momentarily floating right up to the moment that he raped her. When it was over, she made the decision that she had to go. Cindy ran away from the Robersons' home at least 7 times in the last 6 weeks that she lived there. Each time, Charlie caught her and brought her back. He even killed a kitten in front of her and the 4 kids to demonstrate what he would do to them if they did not obey him. Charlie took her snow boots away, but still, Cindy tried once more to escape, running through the snow in her house slippers. This time when Charlie caught her, he drove by her grandmother's house, took a gun out of the glove compartment, and threatened that he would kill her younger sisters if she tried to escape again. Terrified for her sisters, Cindy resigned herself to staying with the Robersons. After threatening to kill her sisters, the sex abuse escalated. Charlie forced her to take pills and would then rape her. He also began to invite some of his friends over, and they took turns abusing Cindy. Sometimes they would just watch as Charlie made her do perverse things, filming her all the while. Charlie kept these films and photographs in a lockbox in his closet. During one of his parties, Carol came home unexpectedly. Cindy thought this would be her moment of salvation. She thought certainly Carol would be horrified and intervene. Instead, Carol got undressed and said, "What have I missed?" And they made Cindy perform oral sex on Carol. These sex parties went on for 2 months. Cindy was trapped. And then on that fateful day, New Year's Eve 1975, Cindy came up with a new plan to escape. Earlier that day, Cindy had called her grandmother's house to wish everyone a Happy New Year. But her sister-in-law answered the phone and told her that there had been a fire at her grandmother's home. Cindy was shocked. Her sister-in-law told her the fire was caused by the lights on the dry and brittle Christmas tree. Though spared by the fire, the house filled up with smoke and was unlivable. So the family had to be split up and dispersed to other relatives' homes. When Cindy offered to help by giving them her Christmas money, her sister-in-law told her that people from the community had come together and donated clothes and money to the family, and everyone was just fine. In that brief conversation, Cindy learned four important things. One, Christmas trees can catch fire. Two, no one was hurt. Three, as a result of the smoke damage, everyone was relocated and given new clothes. Fourth, and finally, their lives were going on just fine. With this realization, an escape plan was born. Because Charlie and Carol were out, she waited for everyone to be at home. Cindy believed she could only light the fire when the whole family was together. Otherwise, she would not be able to escape. You may ask, why in the world would she conclude that? This type of faulty logic is common among long-term child abuse victims, as they often lack the cognitive abilities of their non-abused peers. We know now that sustained neglect or abuse can alter the victim's neurological capabilities. In times of stress, the body releases an excess of the hormone cortisol, or not enough of it. When that happens, the child's cognitive abilities take a dive. They can't think. What is logical to them is quite obviously unreasonable to the normal mind. Cindy's greatest need at this point was merely to survive another day, and that meant getting away from her captors. The news of her grandmother's house fire inspired her new plan. She became excited for a future where she would escape the abuse from Charlie, Carol, and their friends. She would be able to gather up her sisters and leave town. She never imagined that there were any flaws in her plan. One major problem Cindy had was that she'd never experienced a house fire or had even seen one. Her sister-in-law was not at her grandmother's fire, but she made it sound like it was no big deal. The actual danger entailed in starting a fire was a factor Cindy had never considered. In truth, the concept of what one little match could do to a house was as foreign to her as life at the North Pole. When she lit the match to burn the tree, it didn't work. It was a plastic flame retardant tree. So she lit a paper behind a reclining chair and was astonished when, within seconds, the carpet under the tree exploded into flames. Fire quickly consumed the entire room. The tree melted rather than catch on fire. And that is when she ran to wake up Charlie and Carol.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
The fire inspector eventually concluded that the cause of the fire was arson. Investigators discovered naked pictures of Cindy and the Robersons. They also found the love note inside the Snoopy-covered card Cindy wrote years before to Charlie. And a nude picture of her was found in Charlie's wallet. They arrested her, believing that the two were having an affair and that she set the fire after a lover's quarrel. Since Cindy denied all of their accusations, they simply created an explanation as to why she was alive, but the family was all dead. It was pure speculation. The police did not attempt to interview Cindy's sister, her grandmother, any psychiatrists or nurses from the psychiatric hospital, or anyone else who knew Cindy well. They only seemed to want her to confess and acknowledge their theory was true, but she would not. Cindy was too mortified about the pictures to explain them or to tell them she was being held as a sex slave. So they pressed for a polygraph exam, also known as a lie detector test. The term lie detector is a misnomer, as the machine itself does not determine truth or deception. It only measures the physiological manifestations of anxiety, which include rapid pulse and respirations and increased sweating. The polygrapher, a trained and certified so-called expert, makes the call from each question asked as to whether the subject is telling lies or truths. And therein lies the problem, the human factor. Most polygraphers work for or were trained by law enforcement agencies, and a good argument could be made that a likelihood of bias exists. When a cop tells an examiner they want someone tested, the subject, in the eyes of the polygrapher, is high on the cop's list of suspects. The Roberson case was front-page news for weeks, and the only one to survive was a live-in babysitter who was a former inpatient at a psychiatric hospital. Seems only natural that a polygrapher approached by the cops would assume she was, in some way, responsible for the fire. But why request a polygraph? That tells me they didn't have any good evidence. The cops and prosecutor wanted the results of a lie detector test to make the case for them. They assumed she'd fail the test, and they could shout the results to anyone who would listen. They were wrong. There are only three final determinations an examiner can make regarding the graphic results. The subject was truthful, deceptive, or the results were not strong enough in either of those categories, so they are determined to be inconclusive. This simply means the examiner cannot make a definitive call on lying or truthfulness to a question. An inconclusive finding is not good for either side. The defense will usually make the argument that the accused is not necessarily guilty, and police and prosecutors will likely argue an inconclusive determination means the accused very well may have committed the crime. And that is exactly what happened in Cindy White's case. Back in 1976, polygraph exams were all the rage in law enforcement. cops loved them and were convinced they would put the truly guilty behind bars. If a suspect or person of interest refused to take one, that raised suspicion in the cop's mind that the person was hiding something, not that the individual might be rightfully skeptical of the reliability factor. The public was fascinated by the tests, and many believed the machine was infallible. In her heart, Cindy knew that she loved the Roberson kids and would never hurt them. So she naturally assumed the machine would pick up on that feeling and declare her innocent. Unfortunately, her results were inconclusive. For the prosecutor, this was enough to convince the jury she was guilty. Cindy was charged with one count of arson and one count of premeditated murder for the death of Charlie Roberson. The other five deaths resulted in charges of felony murder, which meant each of the other victims died accidentally, yet as a direct result of the arson set by the accused. How the prosecutor determined Charlie's death was premeditated while the others were accidental is beyond me. It was probably because in the state of Indiana at the time, someone convicted of first-degree murder could only be punished by either the electric chair or life without parole. There was no evidence to show that Charlie's death was premeditated or that anybody's death was premeditated. He used that charge to nail Cindy's coffin shut. If she were found guilty, Cindy's life would essentially be over. And from what the public saw, she deserved it. For years, she had been raped by her father, her brother, and subsequently, the Robersons, her bosses. But none of these facts were mentioned at trial as potentially mitigating circumstances, probably because her own attorney never asked. And Cindy was too upset and ashamed and riddled with guilt to bring it up herself. Today, Cindy would have a veritable army of clinicians, psychiatrists, and psychologists to testify in her defense about the effects of sustained sexual and physical abuse. Most importantly, considering what we now know regarding the devastating neurological effects of sustained sex abuse, as well as the way current criminal law is practiced, the outcome of her sentencing would be vastly different. Cindy was tried under the assumption that she was a reasonable adult and acted with the brain of a reasonable 18-year-old of average intelligence. This was a wholly fallacious assumption. We now know that such long-term abuse is capable of arresting or altering a person's emotional, neurological, and psychological development. Therefore, they are not really the adult they are being tried as, despite their age. And Cindy's IQ was determined to be 85, significantly below normal. However, that determination was not made before her trial. It was made in prison where she was tested. All of that means Cindy was incapable of thinking a plan through to its logical conclusion and make a rational, measured decision. For Cindy, life was all about survival. She was not, as the jury saw her, an 18-year-old adult, but rather, as they said at her parole hearing 20 years later, quote, an 18-year-old girl whose emotional and mental development was derailed no later than age 8 by this victimization. And thus, a girl functioning emotionally and mentally at perhaps half her chronological age, or worse yet, at a state of development that was both arrested and also overwhelmingly distorted. But this information wasn't known in 1975 and therefore was not presented at trial. Cindy was found guilty of all charges against her. She was sentenced to the Indiana Women's Prison for no less than 5 years and no more than 20 on the arson conviction, as well as 6 life sentences for each death caused by the arson. While in prison, Cindy attempted suicide 3 times. The prison warden convinced Cindy to join an incest support group, sensing that she had a story to tell. It would take months before she finally had the courage to tell her truth. This was a huge moment for Cindy. Not only did the group believe her story, but no one was angry at her for telling it. After 10 years filled with guilt and self-loathing, Cindy had finally admitted to the abuse. For her, this was life-changing. After another 10 years, she finally confessed to setting the fire. Her secrets were out. She had nothing more to fear. And after several more years of therapy, Cindy finally had hope in her life. At her next parole hearing, surrounded by her new attorney, Charles Asher, the prison warden, and her sister, Cindy felt good about her chances on her 6th attempt at parole. Once again, though, she was denied freedom. Regarding the parole board's ruling, I'm not at all surprised. Certain crimes scream out for one of the 2 most extreme forms of punishment, the death penalty or a life sentence without parole. One such crime is the murder of a child, let alone the murder of 4 children. Let's not forget, Cindy lied at trial and never told the jury her whole story. The childhood sex abuse and later being held as a sex slave. The pictures of the sex abuse parties were passed around to the jury, and they were told by the prosecutor that Cindy was a willing participant. The jury never even heard how she tried to get away 7 times, and no one testified on her behalf. The police and prosecutors painted a dirty portrait of a teenager in love with a married man whose family she killed so they could run away together. Never mind that this theory was spun out of the police and prosecutors' desperation to find a motive, with absolutely no evidence to support it. Never mind that there was a mountain of testimony by eyewitnesses that Cindy ran around the burning house in a threadbare nightgown, desperately trying to get back into the inferno to save people. The very same people the prosecutor said she wanted to kill. So she could be with Charlie? Why would she do that? If she loved him and wanted to run away with him, why kill him? It made no sense. The prosecutor accused Cindy of using an accelerant to start the fire, which they theorized was why it went up so quickly. But no one, including the paramedics or people who helped restrain her, smelled gasoline on her. Why didn't the police test the gasoline cans for fingerprints or her nightgown for gasoline? Lastly, if Cindy wanted to murder the whole family, why didn't she just light the fire and leave? There are many obvious answers to those questions, but those answers were an inconvenient truth for the police and prosecutor. The truth behind why Cindy set the fire and her lack of intent to murder anyone are now known. But the original jury never heard the facts. They were not aware that she was held captive and sexually abused by the adult Robersons, which was backed up by testimonial evidence at the parole board hearing from her sister and the photographs the police found and misinterpreted. 46 years later, Cindy remains a model prisoner. She's been cited for 2 minor infractions, but since 1976, when she arrived, she has never been involved in any violent activity. Not once. When I interviewed her for my show, Facing Evil, and after the cameras stopped rolling, I asked Cindy if she were to be granted clemency someday, what she most wanted to experience. "Candace," she said, "I want to see the stars without the bars." I had the pleasure of meeting Charlie Asher, Cindy's appellate attorney. I asked him to speak with me about Cindy's case. The following is a portion of our conversation.
Cindy White's first trial was a sham, and I would not say that the responsibility necessarily rested with one person, but Cindy was not able to tell, and she had no help to tell what had happened to her. And she had no option really except to live out the messages that she learned in her family, messages of shame, messages of denial, messages of silence. You just endure and you approach the world that way. You approached it as a frightening place where you are not able to say, "I need help and I need to tell you what's going on with me." And so the jury never knew about the sexual victimization in her life. They never knew about her real motivations for setting this fire, which was to escape this abuse. And therefore, what was it about? It wasn't about any real issue of what happened tragically on that day when, in an attempt to save herself and not to hurt anyone, a fire got set that ended in these 6 tragic deaths.
Let me ask you something, Charlie. Back then, in 1976, do you think that if the jury knew about the abuse, it would have made a difference in her sentencing back then?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the difference it all would have made would have been in the lawyers sitting down and coming to a resolution that was something other than this trial. I think she certainly would have had an insanity defense. The insanity defense back then said that the state would have had to have proved beyond a reasonable doubt both that she knew the wrongfulness and that she didn't suffer from an inability to conform her conduct to the requirements of law and society. I think she would have won that, because the issues in the case, like you point out, the real issue should not have been, did she set the fire? She did. If she'd had a tool like defense map, a sensitive attorney, a female social worker to go in and talk, or a female attorney to talk with her without, you know, men peppering her with questions and so forth, I think a different resolution. But if they were forced to trial, I think she probably would have been found not guilty by reason of insanity. And if somebody wants to say, well, it's Cindy's fault that she didn't share, again, I would say, we're back to blaming this 18-year-old victim. Is that right? Is that the best that we can do? It's a sad thought.
How can people listening to this and people that are in agreement with you and I that Cindy should be released, how can people help?
I'm grateful to you and your listeners for pausing to look at this story of this poor child 45 years later. What would be wrong with Cindy White having a little piece of life outside the confines of the Indiana Women's Prison?
I found on the internet 2 different online petition sites. And Cindy has well over 3,000 people that have simply signed the petition simply because they saw her interview with me and believed what you and I believe, that this is a tremendous miscarriage of justice. So what are the next steps for Cindy? What can you and I do?
Right. Well, What I've offered to Cindy was anytime you want to make a claim to the parole board, they're allowed to do it once every 5 years. If they have a disciplinary write-off, they'll be put off. But the other thing, and probably the more logical thing, it's always worth another try, is to go back to that prosecutor's office in Johnson County, Indiana, which I've told her I would do. And if you would go with, you pointed out that the law changed in 1979 after this, where we don't have life sentences for murder in Indiana, or let alone for felony murder. They could, by agreement, convert her sentence to one that would allow her to be out now, and hope that we can confront those incorrect statements that get made that, well, she intentionally killed six people, including four children, and she did it for this crazy, none of which is true, none of which was ever even claimed. And as I say, the state never took the burden of proving any such thing. I hope you'll do it with me. As I've told Cindy, I'll do it anytime. We'll never leave her. If you guys are up for it, I am too.
All of the information gathered for the episodes on Cindy White came from legal documents and interviews with witnesses and Cindy herself. Next week on Killer Psyche, part one of two in What We've Learned So Far, season one. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review. Follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen 1 week early and ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Edited by Joshua Morales and Maxwell Carney, with research and editing assistance from Ann Liu. Our senior audio producer is Tom Monahan. Renee Levesque is production manager. And Haley Mandelberg is production coordinator. Brandon Clark and Lindsay Whistler are production assistants. And the line producer is Oscar Guido. And we would like to give a special thanks to Dr. Seth DeLong. Our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort, and Marsha Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.